Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
Swing and a line drive left field. Benintendi coming on, dives, and did he make the catch? He did! He got it!
Here we go. It's time to party. Right here. 3-2.
High drive! He crushed it! It's a grand slam!
Swing and a miss, strike three, it's over! The Red Sox have won the World Championship!
Welcome to Benny and the Bets Podcast.
Can you believe it?
Here's your host, Terry Cushman.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Benny and the Bets podcast. Tonight, we're going to touch on the World Series, not really do a full recap, but we're going to just give some brief thoughts on it before transitioning over to Red Sox manager talk, some big developments that took place today in Major League Baseball. Going to be an action-packed show. With me tonight, Charlie Smith. Charlie, how are you?
I'm doing good, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing excellent. Postseason transactions off-season transactions starting to, get pretty fluid. And like I said, we're gonna get into a lot of that. But how about that World Series? Six games. The ratings were down, but ratings have been down in every sport. And but I thought it was an entertaining World Series.
So I'll say this much: I think the first four games were incredibly entertaining. The last two, not so much. But Game Four will probably go down as one of the more memorable games in the last, I don't even know how many years, but. What a finish in Game Four. That was my favorite game, and not because I saw the Dodgers lose. It was poetic. I mean, literally, it was a romantic end to a fantastic finish, an absolute just banger. It was so exciting to watch.
Yeah, there's been a lot of epic games, in the World Series. Most series end up having one real good one, and sometimes the reasons are unique. Like for the Red Sox in 2018, it was the 18 inning game, and there was an epic comeback the very next night when Moreland hit that clutch shot. But there's been a lot of heroics. 2016 was obviously epic with the Indians and the Cubs. But that was a great finish. When Taylor kind of booted what should have been just a routine grounder, and then the catcher booted it, and that allowed Rosarena, who was an absolute stud this whole postseason, to come across the plate for that winning run. It was definitely epic. Absolutely epic.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so I guess, there's a lot to take from it, really. Clayton Kershaw had his ups and downs throughout the playoffs, but looked pretty good in both of his appearances, especially I think it was Game One, just absolutely lights out and kind of set the tone for the Dodgers to start the series.
I agree. What was kind of interesting was the narrative that they were trying to go with. They made it seem like Mookie Betts was like the second coming of Christ. Becomes the first person since 1921 to get a walk and two stolen bases in the same inning. okay, cool. You're glorifying someone who's been on the team for literally less than half of a season, like a regular season. Who cares?
Well, you know who the last person to do it was Babe Ruth, so I think they were taunting us. Yeah.
Yeah, I found that to be a little kind of, you know, boorish. I didn't really care for that, and it was, you know, watch as the Tampa Bay Rays take on Mookie Betts and the Los Angeles Dodgers. Like, really? So, all right, let's line up Cody Bellinger, Corey Seager, Clayton Kershaw, Walker Buehler, like all of these stars, and slap them across the face. People that have been here for more than, you know, 60 games, and basically call it the Mookie and Friends show. I just found it to be, you know, not that great. But Clayton Kershaw did not pitch like Clayton Kershaw. This was not the postseason Clayton Kershaw that we were all expecting. A run on two hits, 8 strikeouts, and the only run was on a solo shot. You did your job, and no one can say anything to take that away from you. You know?
Yeah, and you know, I kind of, you know, it's kind of love-hate with me with the Dodgers in certain aspects. Now, I was rooting for Tampa, ultimately, but, you know, Kershaw's a guy, he's classy. You like to see him win. David Price, on the other side of the coin, you know, was cursed throughout his postseason career. Finally gets a ring with the Red Sox, but really, you know, had half the fan base against him, you know, whereas Kershaw's universally loved in L.A. Very classy, so glad to see him get a ring. I think Red Sox fans universally like Joe Kelly still to this day.
Oh, hell yeah.
Nice to see him get a ring. You know, we've talked in recent shows, you know, no one's thrilled about Mookie getting a ring after rejecting us year after year. So, you know, so that's one aspect and, you know, but, you know, they finally got it, you know, in the most messed up year of them all. But yeah, so Kershaw looked good. Tampa starting pitching, not that great though. Glasnow wasn't terrible, but wasn't lights out in his, you know, appearance. And
walked too many batters. He gave up 6 walks in the first in that first game.
Right,
6 earned and 6 walks. Struck out 8 guys. Like, he matched Kershaw there, but 4 1/3 innings, 6 earned runs, 3 hits, no control. Like, that's not going to cut it. And Glasnow was favored by some to be a potential Cy Young candidate. And there's no control there. You can't win if you can't control the ball.
Right. And he might win one eventually, but, you know, but he wasn't an ace by any means in this series. And not quite as bad in game 5, but, you know, did kind of scuffle, you know, gave up 3 runs early. So a little bit of a disappointment there. Charlie Morton we were talking about his spectacular numbers, gave up 5 or 6 runs in his start. So,
yeah, game 3 was brutal. He gave up 5 on 7 hits and 4 1/3. I mean, that was the thing. It was, you know, the Tampa Bay Rays are getting you 5+ 6 innings as starters. They were getting knocked out of the 5th, and they were getting rocked. Glasnow, 6 earned runs. Blake Snell, unfortunately, got screwed in game 2. He only gave up 2 earned runs, 2 hits, struck out 9 and 4 2/3. But they couldn't get out of the 5th inning. They just couldn't. They couldn't save themselves.
Right.
You know, it was what it was. Morton, same thing. And it was just one team who has a starting rotation, and then the other team that has not only a starting rotation, but a starting relieving rotation. Like, you literally have so much depth, you have starters as your long relievers. That's insane. That's literally dumb.
Right.
And you're not going to lose. And I remember earlier we said, I think we were talking, Jason, you and I, you guys had LA in 5 each. So after game 4, I was like, I'm getting 2 apologies, baby. And then game 5 happened. I said, okay, game 6, we really need to win. And for the longest time, it was 1-0. I'm like, oh my God, I might actually be right. LA had so much more firepower. You knew they were going to win. I just, a little biased because I used to live in LA and they didn't do anything when I was there. So I was like, you know what, screw you guys. But I also kind of wanted the small team to win. Like, breaking down game by game, LA showed momentary glimpses, except for game four, because that was just a little silly, momentary glimpses of kind of losing it. Brendan Lau had a couple of homers in game two. Tampa Bay pitching did really, you know, Tampa Bay pitching did pretty good. They didn't get the run support for Blake Snell, though, who only allowed two hits. Game three, Walker Buehler had probably the best outing, period.
Yeah.
A run on three hits, double digits in strikeouts, six innings. And then you got COVID Turner, who had a homer, a couple runs, and a double. Muncy did well. A Rosarena, who I said before the World Series should have been the MVP, had a home run. And then you have Morton got rocked. Game four was the fun one, which you look at the numbers for the Dodgers and you're like, wow, Turner had four hits. Seager had four hits. Each of them had a home run, multiple runs scored, a couple RBIs. Urias allowed two runs on four hits in four and two-thirds, struck out nine. A Rosarena had a home run on the other side of things. And it comes down to the bottom of the, you know, the ninth inning when Chris Taylor, little botch, and we have some life. Game five, Peterson goes yard, and was it Muncy? I think Muncy went yard also. Kershaw, again, does his thing. Glasnow does better. Tampa Bay relievers give up, they give four innings of no-hit baseball, and you think, okay, let's try to get it done, get it done, get it done. It doesn't happen. Game six, it's the Rosarena show with another home run, and then nothing happens until the sixth inning. And they, you know, for some odd reason, in Tampa Bay's infinite wisdom, you pull out Blake Snell, who's given up a hit in five innings, struck out nine batters. I still, to this day, don't know why, and I'll wonder about that one. But that was it. The first four games of the series, really interesting, super close. Last two, no competition. It was LA all the way.
One of my favorite moments of the whole series was actually in Game 5 when Manuel Margot tried to steal home on Kershaw, and he didn't make it, but I respected the ballsiness of attempting to do it. And
hell yeah.
It just seemed like the most Tampa move ever, you know? And you have to make moves like that because so many guys that were great in the regular season for Tampa were just a no-show this series. Joey Wendell hit 111. Austin Meadows, 188. G-Man Choi, 111. Willie Adames, 143. It just was not a good series. Hunter Renfro, 125. I mean, the only bright spots were Margot hitting 316. Yandy Diaz, 333. And Rosarena, of course, 364. Oh, and Brasso, you know, 333. But just some key guys. And some of those guys that weren't hitting were in the one and two hole. Meadows and Lau. Actually, Lau, I didn't mention him. He was really bad. Yeah, he was 125 for the series. So just, you know, that was a big part of it. But getting to the elephant in the room, which you just touched on, Blake Snell getting taken out. And, you know, I've listened to a bunch of podcasts and sports radio in general. I mean, it's universally agreed that this was one of the worst moves by a manager in World Series history. Because, I mean, he was just absolutely mowing them down. I don't have his pitching lineup. He had something like nine strikeouts. He had struck out Mookie Betts twice. Mookie whiffed twice. Yeah. And I'm thinking, as Mookie's coming up to the plate, I'm like, oh, well, you know, they're not going to worry too much about this because, you know, Snell was just completely shutting him down. And that's when Cash pops out of the dugout and goes to Nick Anderson, who gave up, I think, at least a run in six out of his last seven appearances. So
I don't understand that.
Yeah.
I don't get it. It was so dumb. Going into the sixth inning, you're absolutely right. One hit, five innings, nine strikeouts. Nine. He's mowing two guys down in inning. What are you doing? He's not pitching game seven. This could be the biggest game of his life. Dumbest move by Kevin Cash. So stupid.
Absolutely. And, you know, it kicks up the debate where are they going too far with analytics? And I have a huge problem with it, especially when it comes to matchups. Like, I get using analytics to work on their pitch selections and whatnot, and, you know, which, you know, to focus more on the changeup or more on the slider in certain situations. But when it comes to matchups, specifically what Snell, you know, what his numbers versus Mookie Betts over their careers, I don't buy into that type of analytics. And I feel like whenever a team embraces them to the highest degree like that, what you're saying is players don't evolve. Because he, you know, he's got bad numbers against Mookie. He's never going to have good numbers against Mookie. And I hate that because players can make adjustments. They can get better. And I hate seeing that type of, you know, that type of analytics embraced, you know, so intensely.
It's something that I feel like we thank that movie Moneyball for, but also say, God damn you. Because before that, there were very few people and very few teams, organizations that would do anything with advanced analytics, sabermetrics, to really get into the nitty-gritty. If you're a baseball manager and your pitcher has struck out 9 guys through 5 innings in a win-or-die game, why would you ever pull the guy who's already pitched more than half the game out and then put in some guy, and I say some guy, because let's be honest, he's not scaring anyone. Blake Snell was terrifying LA. And let me tell you, if Blake Snell wins game 6, I would put money on it. Honestly, like I said originally, Tampa Bay would have the firepower to shut LA down. Because that's demoralizing, potentially losing a game 1-0.
Yeah, and look at it this way as well. Snell started game 2. And
oh, yeah.
So they already had a good look at him. And, well, he gave up 2 hits, but he walked 4 batters in game 2. And so they already had a good look at him, yet he was far more dominant in game 6. And part of that could be that he's simply rising to the occasion in a big moment, like players need to do in those games. You know, look at John Lackey. Over the course of his entire career, even going back to his Anaheim days, he was never an ace in the regular season. You know, he was probably a number 2 on most teams. I guess on a bad team, maybe he's an ace. But on a team with a solid rotation, he's probably a 2 or a really strong number 3. But in the postseason, he always brought it. He's got a great postseason record. Curt Schilling, another guy, he was an ace, but his postseason numbers were always phenomenal. I think he only had 2 career losses, something like that, and always stepped up. Blake Snell was stepping up in a big game where his team, you know, needed him to be electric and probably could have pitched another inning or two. Was only at 76 pitches, and you know, most big market managers would have let it ride there. Alex Cora would have been a guy who let it ride there, you know, if he was managing Blake Snell. And it's going to be one of those haunting moves for that franchise for a long time. And I tweeted out, you know, early in the series, I said, this could be Tampa's last best chance to win, you know, for quite some time. And it's just too bad it had to end like that. I would have liked to have seen Charlie Morton, you know, have one more shot in game 7. I don't know if he would have been any better than, you know, his game 3 start, but it's...
So I'll say this much. I think that Morton in Game 7 would have righted the wrong, because we've seen what he can do in multiple playoff games, multiple seasons, and multiple teams. I'm still shocked that he ended up getting the yank. I think that they will probably do an ESPN 30 for 30 on COVID season 2020, and this will be one of the more talked about games and moments during the regular season, if not the most talked about. Why, in a deciding game, are you pulling out someone who, believe me, when the season started, I was so over Blake Snell. I was like, dude, just shut up. Just shut up. Stop talking. Go home. You're concerned because you're not getting paid. Homeboy came to get, he showed everybody who the leader is on that team as far as starting rotation goes. Charlie Morton, not in front of Blake Snell. Glasnow, no. Blake Snell is your one. And believe me, if Tampa Bay is going to be wheeling and dealing Snell because they don't want to sign him to a proper contract, he is going to get a ridiculous haul. And it terrifies me to know that he could potentially stay in the division and go to another team that I'm not very friendly with, you know? But I don't see it happening where he would go there because of that team in particular. Yeah, Toronto, I'm talking about you. No, I'm kidding. I can't see him going to New York, but I could see him going to a couple other teams that could get really nasty with the addition of Blake Snell. I feel bad for him. Again, beginning of the season, not happy with him. But now, you can't not respect him for what he was able to do. And just like you mentioned, Terry, they had a good look at him. And you would have thought, okay, they might show a little more oomph. It was the exact opposite. Charlie Morton, I thought he was going to win one and lose one. I think Game 7 would have been a win, and I think Tampa Bay would have been going home World Series champions, and LA would have been, I don't know, probably crying. I don't know, doing something.
I would have loved to have seen it. Yeah, Snell is under control for three more seasons. I wouldn't put it past Tampa, though, to trade him before the end of it to get some type of value. But you make a good point about his future, because when he won his Cy Young, I was like, this guy's a Tampa ace only, meaning he wouldn't be an ace on any other team in any other market that actually has fans screaming in the crowd, you know, adding pressure to a lot of high leverage situations. And, you know, Tampa's a relatively easy market to pitch because nobody shows up. You know, it's a pretty quiet atmosphere and not a ton of pressure. And watching him pitch in the World Series, this is a guy who can probably handle it. And if he doesn't win a World Series with Tampa, pretty good chance he's going to win one with another team and be, you know, the ace of that rotation, or, you know, one of their better starters, you know, if he ends up on a team with a deep rotation. But he made some comments before the season started, you know, back when the union and the league were fighting over what the salaries would be and the number of games. And I didn't appreciate his remarks saying it wouldn't be worth it to play if he couldn't have his full salary, because you're talking about, you know, you're talking about the livelihood and, you know, the well-being of the sport. You know, it could have been extremely detrimental if there was no season whatsoever. And so I wasn't crazy about those comments. And you know, a lot of fans in Tampa, I mean, it was split like 50-50. You know, there were a lot of Tampa fans pissed about those comments. And, you know, I wouldn't like one of our own pitchers, you know, using that type of rhetoric. You know,
I agree. But I agree, and that's what I was saying. Not a fan, but he showed everybody.
Yeah, so I'll let that go now. You know, I got a little bit more respect for him. So, You know, unfortunately, the Dodgers, they finally win the World Series, you know, after winning their division 8 years in a row. I guess, you know, you got to win one eventually, and you know, everything kind of fell their way. And Tampa's going to be a pain in our ass anyway when it comes to the division anyway, you know, trying to win that and avoiding a wild card situation. But we'll see.
Well, you know, when you spend $220 million on a team, you're expected to do certain things. So the expectation for LA was win the World Series or you failed. For all these other teams, it's get to the playoffs. Have a winning record. Just have fun. Not in LA. And that's another thing that really annoys me. I moved to these cities. Like, I moved to LA. They weren't that good. I leave a couple years later, World Series champions. Used to go to school in Philly. Went to school in Philly. Phillies were garbage. I saw their closer blow 3 games in 3 different college nights. I literally couldn't believe my eyes. Following year, they win the World Series. So I'm like, just crap luck. I don't get it. Like, I was able to see the Red Sox win when I moved home, so that was cool. But, oh, my Lord, man. So, yeah, like you, I have a little bit more respect for him now, so if he wants to complain, I have a longer leash for him.
Absolutely. So let's kind of transition over to the Red Sox real quick. Alex Cora could, you know, he could be hired any minute now because once that final out was recorded of the World Series, his suspension runs up. And basically radio silence right now as far as Cora goes. And the interesting thing here is we've heard a couple more names added to the list of interviews. I know one of them was, is it Carlos Mendoza from the Yankees?
He's one. There have been a couple of whispers. I'm so done with Alex Cora, though, and everybody knows I'm done. I don't want to hear his name mentioned again as a part of the Red Sox. I just don't want that garbage. No, thank you. I buy no shares of that.
Yeah, well, we're the two co-hosts on the crew that, you know, that think alike in that area. You know, we don't want him back, but I don't think he's coming back. And, you know, I've thought a lot more about it, you know, since the last show 2 or 3 nights ago. But the writing just seems like it's on the wall that he's not coming back because Bloom has brought in all these guys to interview. And, you know, Venable, of course, I'm going to draw blanks now. The Pirates bench coach there. Oh, Don Kelly. He's interviewed James Rousen, the bench coach for the Marlins. Mendoza from the Yankees. So he's had a lot of talks with a lot of different candidates here. And it just seems to me like he wants to bring in a guy that's going to take very little money. Most managers these days aren't even making $1 million. They're in the 800 to 900 thousands. I think Aaron Boone got 1.2 million. So he did exceed it. Alex Cora was under $1 million until they won the World Series. Then they gave him a raise and whatever, but you're almost done with seeing the big names come in with the huge salaries. Like, for instance, Joe Maddon got $5 million a year with the Cubs. Terry Francona, I don't think quite gets $5 million, but he's, you know, at $3 million or a little above. I don't know what La Russa got. We're going to talk about him a little bit more in depth. I was trying to figure out what his salary was, but for the most part, a lot of teams aren't really paying managers. And with a lot of teams, a lot of these managers are kind of just the middle guy between the players and the analytics department. And I just don't think that Chaim Bloom wants Alex Cora because Cora likes to manage the team. He does use analytics, but not quite to the intensity that Chaim Bloom does. And if you look at the World Series, you had the Rays, who we already know are extremely analytical. That's where Bloom comes from. But on the Dodgers, you have Andrew Friedman, who came from the Rays before taking the Dodgers job. And so you've got two extremely analytical teams in the World Series. So I find it hard to believe that Bloom is going to, you know, come away from Tampa into Boston and then just stop embracing analytics. I think when he arrived, he kind of knew he was going to have to keep Cora. You know, I mean, he was a popular manager with the fans. He's popular with the players. He was popular with the front office, universally popular. Under no circumstances could he move on from Alex Cora. And let's just say for a second he wanted to and was thinking about it. He still can't really do it because he's going to trade Mookie Betts the first opportunity. He's going to make a series of unpopular decisions and then, as fate would have it, build a team that had no hope whatsoever, you know, thanks to the likes of your boy Matt Hall and Zach Godley and Kyle Hart, you know, so he wasn't going to be a popular guy from the get-go, but that Houston scandal afforded him the opportunity to kind of get out of having Alex Cora as the manager. And he's not, of course, they're never going to say that, but so when you take all that into account and you look at all these names that he's interviewed, he's trying to bring in a guy for as little money as possible that's willing to accept the most analytics as possible, you know, and, you know, to take the most orders from him and the analytics department. And it just makes perfect sense to me that that's what's going on. He's trying to recreate Kevin Cash, basically. And I just don't see Alex Cora coming back.
Not only do I not see it coming back, I sincerely hope it doesn't happen. I don't want to hear anybody say, oh, well, they brought the cheater back. I don't want that. We don't need that. We don't want it. I mean, we have enough dirty laundry now with, you know, players that have gotten traded and have, you know, left/made remarks that are not very popular. And there's actually like a tweet that I want to talk about from Mookie Betts later on that still is kind of annoying me, but it is what it is. As far as Alex Cora is concerned, I'm with you 100%. I stand behind you, Terry.
No. Yeah, and another thing too is Bloom didn't want to come into 2020 with Dave Dombrowski's baseball team. You know, he wanted to make a bunch of moves, kind of overhaul it a little bit. You kind of saw it with Peraza, guys like him. That didn't work out though. But, you know, he brought in a bunch of, you know, different guys, Kevin Pillar, for instance. And Alex Cora is a part of Dave Dombrowski's team, you know, and I just think he wants to put his own stamp on Boston, and he's hardcore analytical. I can't see him, you know, getting away from analytics when you had two hardcore teams in the World Series, both number one seeds. So it scares me a little bit. The one upside to Cora, I still don't want him, is at least you knew he was the manager and he was ultimately calling the shots. Now, if you have analytics, just think for a second. Imagine a pitcher. I'm not going to use Sale as an example because that would be a bad one. He would go kicking and screaming off the mound. But say we bring in Jake Odorizzi and he's having, you know, the best season of his career. And he's in the playoffs, and he's got an ERA for the year in the low twos. You know, he's a, you know, top seven or eight Cy Young guy. And let's say he's mowing down a team in the playoffs, and the third time in the order comes up, because that's the boogeyman these days, and whoever the Red Sox manager is yanks him, you know, whether it's that Zurita guy or, you know, I'm drawing blanks again. I'd say it's Venable, and Venable's the manager, and he pulls Odorizzi after mowing down all those guys. The Boston fan base is not going to tolerate a move like that. They're not going to tolerate that type of analytics.
Right.
It's not going to work in Boston. And so that scares me. I don't want that type of baseball, you know, in this market. So it's going to be interesting. But one way or the other, I don't see it being Alex Cora. And the interesting thing here is A.J. Hinch, not official yet, but a lot of sources coming out of Detroit that he's going to be the guy to take over for Ron Gardenhire, who, you know, resigned basically the last week of the season. And so Detroit's off the market, and that's a destination team because they might not compete necessarily in 2021, but most of their top prospects are up. It is a team historically that's willing to spend money. So I think within a year or two, they're going to be competing for the division. They've got the talent, and that would be a team that a manager, a top manager who wants to win in the near future, would like to go to. But that's going to Hinch, apparently. That's off the board. Chicago, right. Another destination team, a team that did make the playoffs this year, you know, even though it was a funky format. That's a destination team as well. Tony La Russa gets that job. So there's really no other jobs for Alex Cora outside of Boston. Now, I was talking with Andrew earlier, you know, via DM, and I'm wondering, you know, could a team like maybe the Texas Rangers, the Seattle Mariners, the Colorado Rockies, the New York Mets, would one of those teams fire their manager if the opportunity to bring in Alex Cora was out there? I don't know if I mentioned the Mariners in there, but that's a team. They're probably 2 or 3 years away, but you know, they are kind of gaining some steam. I'm just wondering if maybe if the Red Sox don't hire him, you know, maybe you see a sudden firing in one of those teams and they bring him on. But it's not going to be one of the, you know, the more highly desired teams anyway.
Right.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to say the least. Like, there's no question there. It's going to be interesting. And I think it's going to be up there with some of the more like, huh? Moves of the year. You know, like, it could potentially be like, huh? Wait, what? Like,
well, there was one of those today, you know.
Oh, I know. That's kind of, I'm kind of alluding to it, but well, I'm sure we're going to cover that shortly.
Yeah, no, go ahead. I mean, we'll just dive right into Chicago because, you know, we were hearing the La Russa rumors, but kind of a, you know, an awkward fit, you know, given the recent trend. You know, a lot of managers are almost half his age getting hired. La Russa's 76. You can't see a headline of him being hired without his age being in the headline. And, you know, it was rumored, but, you know, a lot of people thought, well, maybe conventional wisdom will eventually, you know, win that organization over and they would go for a Hinch or a Cora. But now that it's a done deal, what are your thoughts?
I'm a little bit, you know, curious about it because, I mean, he goes back to the team that he originally became the manager for. He ended that tenure in 86. So he has literally not been a manager for this team longer than I've been alive, and he's going back to it. You know, this is just, it seems a little silly because he did the White Sox gig, Then he did the Athletics. He won a World Series there. Then he went to the Cardinals. He was there for like 15 years. He won a couple of titles there, retired when he won. And then 10 years went by, and we're like, all right, cool. You know, he's had a great career. And it's like Jack McKeon all over again. Like, oh, well, who's the oldest manager in baseball? Jack McKeon. He was around during the time of Jesus Christ. What was Jesus like? Tony La Russa's like that. You know, like nothing against him or anything, but it's just kind of like, I don't understand why you're going to hire a manager who's 50 years older than some of the players. I mean, if you ask the players, oh, what do you think of, you know, Fetty Wap and Eminem, Slim Shady, Miley Cyrus, and Justin Bieber, Tony La Russa is going to say, who are they? You know, like, I'm just curious on the level of connection. There's no question. This guy is going to go down as one of the best managers of all time. He's won, I'm guessing, close to 3,000 games now. Like, he's won a lot of games. And he's won 3 World Series titles. There's no question about his talent. I'm just curious as to why he thought going back into being a manager would be an interesting idea. I mean, a good idea. It's going to be interesting. Chicago has a great team. But let me tell you, like, this was the most kind of head-scratching bit of news in baseball today as far as manager stuff went. Like, players, totally different story. But, I mean, I'm curious to see what happens. Like, what's going to happen with some of these young guys? Like, how are they going to get along? How are they going to mesh? Like, it's not like having an Alex Cora type, someone who's like, you know, he might be 10 years old than some of your players. He's 50 years older. He may be 2-3 times the age of some of his players, which is mind-blowing. So I'm curious to see what happens. It's a questionable move. It's a curious move. But I have nothing bad to say about Tony La Russa. So props to him. I appreciate his time in Boston for the little bit that he was here. But, you know, 10 years have gone by, so I'm curious to see what happens.
Yeah, I didn't get to read Passan's article, Jeff Passan, but it sounds like the La Russa hiring was a ownership decision, much like we saw in Boston, you know, at the start of the 2012 season with Bobby Valentine. You know, a lot of us thought Dale Swaim was going to be the next manager of the Red Sox after Francona, and that was the guy Ben Sherrington liked, and then he kind of had his toe stepped on when Lucchino brought in Valentine, and we know how that worked out. Now, I don't think Chicago has to worry about, you know, the circus aspect of what we went through. I think La Russa, like you said, is a respected guy. 3, you know, championships as a manager. 1989, the Earthquake World Series, he won it with Oakland. And then again in 2006 and 2011, before retiring, like you said, going out, you know, with a championship. And, you know, it's interesting, but it was an ownership decision. And there's been other reports that there's a lot of rifts going on in the front office in Chicago. A lot of executives within that front office upset that that was the course of action. So it's tough, you know. I'm intrigued. You know, I guess I love the nostalgia of it. I don't know that that's going to translate to success. I will say that I couldn't have been more impressed with 71-year-old Dusty Baker with the Houston Astros. And I know we hate those guys for what they did, and they've got a lot of players on that team who are, you know, easy to hate as well. But, you know, Baker didn't have much of a pitching staff outside of Greinke and McCullers. His bullpen, nobody knew what they had because they lost Ozuna right away. And he just seemed to figure it out. And maybe the analytics guys had a lot to do with that in Houston. But I thought Baker by far exceeded my expectations. And a lot of us thought they were going to beat Tampa, you know, going into game seven. You know, they had all the momentum, and it looked like they could very well go to the World Series with Dusty Baker, but luckily, you know, came up a little short. Now, with La Russa, you're going to see a lot of old school, you know, mentality with the moves that he makes. He's got a lot of talent, so, you know, there's a lot of different ways he can go. I don't know that Chicago is a hugely analytical organization. I just, you know, they haven't been good for very long, so I just haven't really gotten to know them that well in that regard. But I think at face value, with his successful career, we don't hear any bad things about La Russa. Like, there's nothing bad about, you know, his record. And he was a very long tenured manager with St. Louis. Let's see. Yeah, he was there for 15 years, 96 to 2011. Got two championships in that span, like I said. But this is a guy who I think can get the respect of his players. So it's going to be interesting. You know, it's going to make me that much more curious to watch them. But the fan base is like burning everything down. You know, half the front office is pissed off, and you know, so we'll see. We'll see.
Yep.
But yeah, I thought I had another thing to get to on him, but yeah.
I was actually doing some research. You know, Tony La Russa is well respected, well regarded by Major League Baseball. The man is also brilliant outside of baseball. Before pursuing a career in baseball, the guy actually got his Juris Doctorate. He's a lawyer.
Oh, wow.
Which I didn't even know. Like, I was just kind of like, you know, Tony La Russa, you know, he looks wise. He looks like anything that comes out of his mouth is just going to be like a, wow, what a brilliant mindset. Like, how interesting. Like, that's, I've never thought of it that way. And then I looked at it and I was like, holy crap, the guy has a Juris Doctorate from Florida State, you know, which is also kind of mind blowing. But, you know, it's going to be fun to see him, you know, see him manage again. It'll be weird seeing him manage not wearing a Cardinals jersey. But you can't not be happy for him because he's doing what he loves. He loves baseball. So props to him.
Yeah, he looks like he's in good shape. I'd be curious to see. Is he the oldest manager ever? See, I really should have done a little bit more research on him.
No, Jack McKeon was Jack McKeon was a manager in his 80s.
Oh, was he? Okay.
Wasn't he?
He was up
maybe,
there.
Maybe it was the 70s. I could have sworn they brought him back for a short period of time. Let me see. 2011, he became a manager again. He was 81.
Oh, okay.
81 years old. He was 72 years old when he won a World Series. I remember that because when I was watching, I was like, Dad, he just won a World Series at 72. Like, most people are retired at 72 playing golf or playing cribbage. Like, you know, that's an ode to you and me, Terry. or bridge or something. Like, what in the world pushed this man to come back to it? Because he was a manager and then he came back 6 years later. But he was 72 when he won a World Series, 81 when he came back. That's insane.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's an older one.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll find out shortly. Yeah, and he's still alive, too. He'll be 90 in November, on November 23rd.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely some good genes or whatever. And like you said, 0-3 against the Yankees, him versus Joe Torre. So good for him, you know, to win that World Series. And the World
Agreed.
Series that La Russa retired on, 2011, one of the greatest World Series I've ever seen. I mean, Texas was a strike away from winning that a couple times. It had the pitcher.
I know.
Yeah.
That was insane.
That was an epic World Series.
Wasn't 2011, wasn't that the David Freese home run?
Yeah, and And then Nelson Cruz botched a ball at the warning track. And, Ron Washington gets criticized quite a bit for how he managed that. But that was just an epic World Series. And the guy was, I think, 67 at the time. So, yeah, why wouldn't he retire? How many guys stick around past that? You know, he'd been managing for 15 years. It's just so crazy.
Right.
So crazy that he's back. And like Andrew said, it's an organization that he's got no recent connections with. You know, so it didn't make a ton of sense, but it was an ownership decision. And actually, a couple of things now that might, you know, come to mind. Chicago, the White Sox is an organization that does have a culture problem at times, because go back a handful of years ago, either Rick Hahn, the GM, or the owner wouldn't allow kids in the clubhouse, you know, during the day. And, you know, that caused Adam LaRoche to retire. And he had like a $10 or $12 million season still to be played. And he walked away from that money. And he didn't make a ton of money during his career. It wasn't like he's David Price and could opt out because he, you know, had made so much money. So, you know, there was issues there. And then there was an issue with the guys on the team were like stiffing clubhouse attendance because customarily they'll tip them every day, because the attendance of the Gophers, you know, they literally go to the supermarkets to buy the food that the players want. And I think it was happening though on the road when they were doing it, so that was a minor controversy. The Chris Sale shredding the jerseys, you know, you can probably blame a lot of that on Sale, but I think it still speaks to the fact that the culture there was toxic. And, you know, so the Renteria firing was a little surprising to me, given the fact that they had made the playoffs. I think some of the fan base was a little surprised at that, only to get Tony La Russa. But it's an organization that just, you know, it isn't run very well. And go back to the Chris Sale trade. They had a pretty talented team when they decided to blow it up. You know, they still had Quintana, who was thought to still be a guy who was going to be a top of the rotation guy. You know, Sale obviously at the top of it. They had Adam Eaton in their lineup. You know, a lot of talented guys all the way through the lineup. Like, if they just added a couple more pieces, they probably compete for the division, but they blew it up. And, you know, it was right after the Chris Sale incident, which wasn't long after the Adam LaRoche incident. And I guess they wanted to change the culture, change the chemistry a little bit. And it ended up being what, a 5 or 6 year rebuild. So, you know, it's just not a lot seems to make sense in Chicago, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Maybe they need a new GM. I mean, he's been there through all of this, and maybe that's right. The route they need to go, you know.
You're right with the Sox, because they had a couple guys on that team. You know, that was back when Dave Robertson was there. Carlos Rodon was there, and people thought that Rodon could have been a superstar. You had a solid 1-2-3 situation. I don't understand, you know, that's going to be one of those moves that I think people will continue to be a little bit kind of, about. But at the time, we thought, oh, man, we're making out. Now Chicago's laughing. They are laughing so hard.
Yeah. And another thing, you can tell I clearly didn't take notes on La Russa specifically. He was kind of taking some heat today on Twitter, because apparently he was critical of Fernando Tatis on that grand slam with the 3-0 count. Remember, you know, some apparently, well, you know, the opposing manager, I think it was the Woodward, the Rangers manager. It was an interleague game, and he was the one who started getting sour about Tatis swinging on the 3-0 count. And then Jace Tingler awkwardly threw his player under the bus and said, yeah, he probably shouldn't have swung there and whatnot.
So dumb. Well, so stupid.
Right. Well, La Russa was also critical of him swinging there, that it was unsportsmanlike. And of course, that doesn't fit with this new generation because, you know, some of the unwritten rules just don't play. And now you have, you know, bat flips and pimping home runs, which never would have, you know, that wouldn't have, you know, been acceptable, you know, as recently as 10 years ago. I mean, you're not going to do that off of Josh Beckett or John Lackey or, you know, Curt Schilling. You know, none of those guys are going to tolerate those antics. But, you know, the sport's evolved a little bit, and you're starting to see that. So I guess it's just really important for La Russa to go in there and get off on the right foot. And I think he can do it because, like I said, he doesn't have a history of controversy for the most part. And players historically have loved playing for him. So...
Agreed. I think when it comes to the pimping home runs, you hit on that too. Like, it was super frustrating. Like, yeah, dude, you know it's a home run. Just start running, please. Games are already lasting 18 hours. Can we please keep it under 15? Just like one time. And there were two pitchers in the 90s and 2000s and before that I would never pimp a home run on, regardless of the situation. And the first one is Tom Glavine, because I always found him to be a classy guy. You never saw any negative things about him. He was a longtime Brave and then Cub and did everything the right way. You know, that's one guy. The other guy who I'm not pimping a home run on is Randy Johnson, because I don't want to die. And that man is 6'10". He could consume you and still be hungry for seconds. So why in the world would you do that? You're right. It's a new generation, you know, but I mean, players have to recognize you pimp me once, you're catching one to the shoulders or higher, you know? So pitchers can retaliate and people want to get at pitchers for it. But it's like, if you don't pimp the home run, you won't catch, you know, dome heat. It is what it is.
Yeah. I don't really fight that battle anymore. Cause it's going to get more prevalent and, you know, ultimately there's nothing I can do about it. But, you know, you remember the Bautista one from 2016 against Texas, and that of course led to Odor knocking him out the next season.
That was so worth it. Oh man, that was worth the price of admission.
Right, but that was one that didn't go over well, and that wasn't even all that long ago. And you know, and the thing I still hate about it is you see Max Muncy pimping one. I can't remember if it was in game 5 or 6, but he kind of pimps one, and I'm like, these guys are pimping these juiced ball home runs that, you know, are just flying out of the park. I mean, if these were real baseballs, you know, I mean, Manny Ramirez, Barry Bonds, you know, so many of their balls died at the warning track, you know, because they were hitting real baseballs. They weren't hitting these juiced baseballs, but, you know, Muncy's getting these easy home runs, you know, because of the balls. And I guess the bats are different now too. And he's pimping them like he's some stud or whatever, when, you know, 10, 15 years ago, a lot of these balls aren't flying out of the park. So, you know, they're fake home runs, you know, as far as I'm concerned. And I hope that they deaden the ball a little bit so that it doesn't get too ridiculous. I mean, I don't want 7 guys next year breaking, you know, Roger Maris's record of 61. I mean, there's just no integrity in that.
I remember when, do you remember when, this is almost 10 years ago now too. It's probably, 2020. Jared Weaver was with the Angels at the time. He's been out of baseball for, what, 7, 8 years? Maybe less. 7 years, maybe more. I don't remember. When Carlos Guillen decided to pimp a home run on him, and he was like, no, we won't have that. Not today. Not ever. Not with you. And the other guy, when it comes to Max Muncy, the only thing that goes through my mind is, dude, you're a nobody. Like, you play for the Dodgers. You're not the best player. The hell are you doing pimping home runs? What are you doing?
Right.
That's like someone who pimps their first major league home run and pimps the second one like 4 years later. Like, oh, wow, that's pretty sweet. That's what it looks like. I guess, you know, you only did it twice in your life. But Max Muncy's going to hit a lot more home runs. There's no need for that. There's really none. I'm with you there.
Yeah. And like I said, it's, you know, that's what they want to see because it appeals to the younger crowd and they want more younger fans. So it's just a battle I'm not going to fight, but I will laugh the hardest when they get punked by whoever the pitcher is in their next at bat.
Yep. So. And while we were off, or while I was doing a little research off the mic here, Jack McCain is the second oldest manager when he came back at 80, just under 81. Connie Mack was 87 years old. He is the oldest manager. But the oldest manager as far as tenure goes, Jack McCain wins that award at 81. So that answers that question from earlier.
Okay. I've heard of Connie Mack. Admittedly, I'm not good with baseball history. Who did he manage? I'm pulling it up.
Connie Mack was a longtime manager for the Athletics, and then he was a hybrid manager because my dad is a huge baseball person too. He also worked with the Pirates. He's won multiple World Series. He's in the Hall of Fame, and has been in it for decades. But if you mention Connie Mack and you look at his numbers, he holds a lot of records and has won 4, 5, 6 World Series titles. Like he's done it.
Five of them.
He's five. He's done some great work.
He was the manager for the Philadelphia Athletics for 49 years uninterrupted. So that's who he won all his titles with. 49
Isn't
years.
Isn't that stupid? That's just dumb.
I'm 37, and he still had a long way to go. You know, he still had another dozen years after.
Crazy, you know, right?
Yeah, but it was a different world back then. He was born in the 1800s, let's see.
1862.
62, and he died in 56, so he was in his 90s. But, yeah, that was definitely a different time. But, yeah, so in the modern era, you know, La Russa and McKeon, you know, two of the oldest to ever do it. So,
yep.
Yeah. Yeah, well, all right. So we'll keep an eye on Chicago with that development. I can't remember if we've touched on it yet. AJ Hinch, most likely to the Tigers, not official yet, but the rumors are pretty heavy there. One interesting thing before we get into some player transactions, no Carlos Beltran, no interviews. And he was, you know, a popular candidate last winter. And someone who was always thought to be a future manager, and not a peep from him. So I think that's pretty interesting. He supposedly, depending on which report you believe, had a pretty hands-on role in the Houston scandal. So
yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you see Hinch getting an opportunity, possibly locking it down. Cora. We still don't know yet. But here's the thing. If Cora doesn't get a job as a manager, Beltran's not getting one.
No, because Cora had a pretty, you know, pretty significant role in it as well. That's what I was kind of wondering. See, I tweeted just the other day that I'd be surprised if Cora or Hinch get a job. And now we're seeing that Hinch likely will. Who's the most culpable here? Would it be Cora, who is a hands-on guy in the scandal, or is Hinch even worse because his failed leadership allowed it to not only continue but thrive? So
I blame Hinch.
You think he has more to blame? Yeah,
he's the highest head on the totem pole there, you know.
Yeah,
he knew what was going on. He knew full well. And then, you know, Cora's not much better, but he wasn't the manager. So if the roles were reversed, I would say Cora over Hinch. And I'm a Red Sox fan. and he was my manager, you know? Mm-hmm. I blame the guy who you got to blame the top dog. This is your job. Your job is to ensure that your team is following the rules and staying in order. You didn't keep your ducks lined up in a row. This falls on you, sir.
Yeah. And it's hard to tell which one is the better manager. I mean, Cora ended up beating him in 2018, but, you know, Hinch, obviously, I mean, this was, what, their fourth ALCS, so that meant three of them came under him. And, yep. You know, a World Series win and a World Series loss in Game 7. So I don't know who would be highly desired. Obviously, Red Sox fans are going to say Cora because, you know, he was their guy. But we'll see. There's no obvious job for Cora outside of Boston. And like I said, I don't think Bloom wants him. And I think he wants his own guy. But let's get into some player transactions. We're going to get into one specifically that could be a player we end up acquiring. But just some others to touch on. The Brewers declined Ryan Braun's option. I'm sure he'll still be sought after for a team that's looking for a third outfielder, you know, just to kind of plug in with two more. Atlanta comes to mind, depending on what they do with Markakis. And maybe, who knows, maybe even the Red Sox. I'd hate to see him come to Boston, but somebody will sign him. Darren O'Day, his option not picked up by the Braves. You know, he's one of those submariner-style pitchers. Zach Britton's option was picked up by the Yankees, so him and Chapman will remain in that tandem. But the notable one of the day, Brad Hand, very stunningly not picked up by the Cleveland Indians. So the Red Sox are fourth in line on the waiver wire. Pittsburgh, Texas, and Detroit are ahead of us. There's no real reason for Pittsburgh or Texas to acquire him and spend all that money, given the fact that they're not, you know, expected to compete. Detroit's a bit of a wild card. Tough to know what their priorities are this offseason, whether they would want to pick him up or not. He's flippable, you know. If he's pitching well in the first half of the season, they could do it and then trade him. So there could be a motive there. But if not, he would fit perfectly in the Red Sox hands and really give our bullpen a new look and make us a pretty good bullpen. If you figure in, you know, Darwin's and Hernandez still being a late inning guy, Josh Taylor, you know, being a guy that will probably be pretty solid. Hard to knock Brazier at this point, you know, had a hell of a resurgence. So that's a pretty good bullpen. And I still like Matt Barnes in a situational role. So I'm intrigued by Brad Hand. And I know Andrew is as well. What are your thoughts?
I'm just confused why you're going to release outright to waivers the guy who led the league in games finished and saves. He had 16 saves in 2020. Oh yeah, he didn't give up a home run. What are you doing? So unless I'm missing something, like you're looking at it, they opted not to pick up the 2020 option of $10 million for Brad Hand. Let's look at how much they have on payroll. $64 million. So you've got Lindor, who's getting $22 million. Because, mind you, in 2022, you've got a bunch of free agents. You only have $14 million committed on the books right now. That's it. So why wouldn't you grab him for another year? Your team was phenomenal. You'd also have one of the best closers in baseball for $10 million. So unless the goal is to release him, hope that no one adds him, which is insane, and then re-sign him to a more friendly deal, I don't understand why they made this move. I mean, this one is just, it's up there with the, this may actually be, I don't know what's more shocking, La Russa going to Chicago or this. I don't know. Honestly, it's like 50-50 because this one makes no sense. 50 saves in the last two seasons. His ERA was just over 2. He gave up 5 earned runs in 22 innings. Had a .77 whip.
Maybe he's injured. You know, maybe they know something. I'm just spitballing. You know, he's probably not, but, you know, it's such a puzzling move that I have to wonder. You could possibly say maybe a lot of these teams are strapped because they didn't really generate revenue. Maybe it's just they just simply can't afford to, you know, to pick up that option. But then again, he should be flippable. I mean, a team would be interested in him, and I don't know what the return would be, but you should net at least one decent prospect. I would say a top 10 prospect for an arm like that. It really is puzzling. And, I mean, doesn't anybody have trade value anymore? It makes me wonder what the Red Sox might be up to. Like, what shocking move are we about to witness?
I mean, I literally was left very confused when that got, you know, announced. It really, 2020 has just been a year of just a bunch of firsts where rules are getting changed and players are, you know, opting out, not playing. Players are playing and players are playing out of their minds. Other players, you know, forgot to show up. It's been very, very interesting all season long. But I don't know. Like, I feel like you're dropping one of the best closers in baseball for what? I don't know. It's just, like you said, maybe it's for injury. We don't know. We'll find out. And I'll be patiently waiting for that one once that gets released because I really want to know what happened there. 100%.
Well, Bloom got rid of Travis Lakins last fall, and that surprised me because he seemed like a guy who had some upside. And I remember after he got called up late, Cora kind of used him in a couple of really high leverage situations, brought him in with like runners on with maybe a one run lead and just situations that weren't ideal for a young pitcher. And, you know, unfortunately some of those runs ended up scoring and he didn't look great in spots, but I still thought there was some upside. And when they got rid of him, I'm like, oh, maybe he's injured. And then, of course, the Orioles pick him up. And he did pitch this year, and I don't have his stats up, but seemed healthy. And so, you know, like I said, Bloom's not going to be attached to anybody. He traded Mookie Betts. So who knows what tricks he has up his sleeve. I don't know if Andrew Benintendi can be non-tendered because he signed a short-term contract that basically bought up his arbitration. So he's got 2 years left on that. And so I don't know what the, you know, the technicalities are for some of these contracts, but I could see him not being in the organization on opening day somehow, you know, if he's not non-tendered. But I think we are in for a surprise. The longer we sit here, I don't think Martin Perez is necessarily going to be picked up with his cheap option of $6 million, which sounds crazy because he's a durable guy and has been pitching better the last couple of years. But you know, if they want an upgrade, you know, he's probably the casualty, you know, to get that John Lester type guy or Jake Odorizzi or whoever. And I'm not even sure Odorizzi is really an upgrade over Perez at this point. Coming off a bad year, he might, but
It's all up in the air. I mean, it's just one surprise move after another. I feel like we haven't even scratched the surface of moves that are going to be leaving us kind of scratching our domes.
Yeah. You know, there's a few more days. Well, actually, it's 5 days, so probably just a couple days for the options and stuff to be picked up. And a lot of teams will be getting their rosters down. You know, I the player pool thing, you know, down to the 40 man. I don't know how any of that's going to work, actually. But there's also uncertainty as well. You know, are we going to have a full season next year? I don't see how we can if there's going to be no fans in attendance. I think they're going to want to shorten it up again, but you know, we'll see.
Yep.
What was going on with Mookie? You said,
oh yeah, Mookie Betts over here. As soon as the Dodgers won, the World Series, he had a tweet that came out on the 28th saying, you know, the job is finished. This one's for ULA, the city of champions. Enjoy the hell out of it. But you know, these boys aren't done chasing rings. Now, depending on what part of LA you're in, you are a little bit higher above sea level. So maybe in a moment of just poor decision, he forgot that the city of champions was where he used to play. But maybe because, you know, the Lakers won, you know, kind of in honor of, you know, the passing of Kobe Bryant, and the Dodgers finally lived up to the expectation and actually won, albeit spending $220+ million on your payroll, maybe now you can call LA the city of champions. LA's won one World Series in 32 years. Lakers really haven't been relevant in a decade. So maybe I'm misunderstanding the term city of champions, because that would imply that you guys won a lot.
Right.
So I don't know. I found that to be kind of like a shot at Boston there.
Yeah.
Like, please don't forget, we wanted you here. You didn't want to be here. So let's not forget that. Mookie Butts for being an ass and tweeting such garbage.
Right. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see, you know, over the course of the next decade, who wins more titles. You know, the Dodgers already have one, so, you know, the Red Sox are probably, I mean, I wouldn't be shocked if the Red Sox won the 2021 World Series. I really wouldn't. You know, if the pitching lines up, you know, if they make the right moves in the offseason, because, I mean, who thought at the beginning of 2013 we were going to win the World Series with Lester and Lackey at the top of our rotation? I mean, it just, that didn't sound good enough to me at the time. You know, it could have been a competitive team, but I certainly didn't see World Series. And I didn't start even thinking that anyway until like late August. I mean, we led the division all year. I think Tampa took it for like a few days and then we went back on top. But it wasn't really until late August of that year where I'm like, geez, you know, maybe we can. And I still favored Detroit all the way up until that series started. I wasn't on Twitter at the time, but if I had to pick, I probably would have thought Detroit was going to beat the Red Sox with Verlander, Scherzer, and Anibal Sanchez had the lowest ERA in the American League that year. Best season of his career by far. You know, so you got that for your 1-2-3. I couldn't. And Cabrera, that might have been the triple crown year for him. You know, those guys all stepped up. And Lackey, like I said, always stepped up in October. And Lester's, you know, except for maybe the last couple of years, he's older now. But, you know, the first two-thirds of his career was always a phenomenal postseason pitcher anyway, right from the get-go. They stepped up. But you know, am I going to pick the Red Sox to win the World Series under any circumstances in 2021? No. But if we're in first place by August 20th and firing on all cylinders, we might have Chris Sale back by then. Yeah, I wouldn't be shocked if we did win it. So that's part of why this offseason is, you know, so exciting. And, you know, we got so many prospects that could be up by then as well. And I'm really excited about Tanner Houck, you know, based on the three starts we've seen and just how comfortable he looks on the mound. Like, it's the moment just hasn't been too big for him. And I know fans aren't in attendance, which, you know, can be a factor, but yeah, I think we got some upside
for sure.
Yeah.
I'm not expecting 2021 to be a gas year. Like, I don't think anyone's going to be looking at Boston saying, oh crap, we should be worried.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not going to be one of those years. We have to be realistic, you know?
Right.
Like, we dumped, just kind of overhauled the entire rotation, for lack of a better term. And we just, we're not going to be competitive until Chris Sale comes back and we get another couple pieces.
Right. Yeah, I'm cautiously optimistic. If we get that piece and then Evaldi is healthy until Chris Sale comes back, I think you can make a case. And I don't think the Yankees are going to be a juggernaut. They have a ton of decisions to make, and a lot of them are probably going to be bad decisions. You know, if Judge gets that massive extension and maybe they do something stupid like bring Tanaka back on a 4 or 5 year deal when the dude's clearly losing it.
Right.
And, you know.
It looks like Tanaka's actually going to be headed back to Japan. That's been rumored because of the team that he used to play for offering him possibly more money to play there than in New York. So, I mean, shoot, why wouldn't you at this point?
And he could be picky about the markets he plays in over here. Like, he doesn't want to go to Baltimore or, you know, probably even Detroit. You know, he
right.
seemed pretty partial to the New York market. So going home could definitely be more appealing to him. But nonetheless, I don't see the Yankees really being the team that we thought they were going to be this year. You know, I don't think they're going to be super stellar next year. With that said, I mean, could they still win the division? Absolutely.
Sure.
But
yeah.
And Tampa, you just never know. I mean, if the stars align and they're firing on all cylinders, they could win it. But I just think if the Red Sox do make the right moves, it's not out of the realm of possibility that they could, you know, end up winning the division. Yeah, we're you know, as you know, looking for a co-host, and, you know, I haven't pitched it yet, but this could be like a golden era for Red Sox podcasting, really.
Yeah, for sure.
Because we're
for
at
sure.
the start of
a lot of people.
Start of a new era, and I'm excited. You know, even if this season doesn't quite pan out, the future is definitely bright, and you know, we got some prospects that are ready to be called up. You know, Casas, I don't know if he'll be up this year, or Brian Mata, but they're pretty close. So we'll see. We're at an hour and 21 minutes, so I guess we'll wrap it on that. I totally lost track of time there, but good
yeah,
show.
Yeah, me too. I talk too much. Yeah, for sure.
So good.
A pleasure, as always.
Yeah, good show, Charlie. All right, well, we'll be in touch, and I'm sure throughout the day tomorrow, and who knows when the manager decision's going to come down, but it's going to get hot and heavy for sure.
There it is.
All right. Take care, Charlie.
See you, bud. Be well.
Episode 229 in the books. Hope you liked it. Longer than I anticipated it would go, but a lot of fun topics. And it's just nice to be talking about baseball one way or the other, regardless of what month it is or what the circumstances are. You know, we're here to talk about our favorite sport, and we hope you enjoy it. So take care.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. TNCs apply, in-app only.